Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Andy Boyd. My guest today on the program is Adam Bronkowski, author of Cultural Responses to Occupation in Japan. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Andy. Good to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure, no problem. First off, I wonder if you might give us some of your kind of personal slash scholarly background and how you became interested in Japanese culture, particularly this sort of post-1945 period that you write about in the book.
Yeah, so I guess my interest in Japan came from having lived there as a junior high school student, moving from tiny little Canberra in Australia to megalopolis Tokyo in the 1980s. I lived there with my mother, and then I learnt Japanese, you know, knocking around with kids at school, and then I came back as a undergrad exchange student for a year on a Japanese government scholarship and studied more and learnt a bit more about Japan. And then I came back again to make a documentary about Japanese subcultures. Later on, once I'd started as a theatre artist, and then it went from there. I came back again in the early 2000s, where I joined a Japanese theatre company called Gekidan Kaitaisha, which means Theatre of Deconstruction, a very light term. And I also went back to academia in that time because, to be paid as a theatre professional in Japan is a little bit more difficult. So I had to have some sort of vocation outside. So I got a scholarship and did my master's. And then I went on enjoying that into a PhD. And from there I wrote the book. So the interest in the post-1945 period, I guess, is trying to understand the theatre that I was making, what its roots were, what its ideas were, what it derived from, what were the political and social conditions it kind of emerged from and was immersed in, and how, in particular in Japan, given that long kind of interspersed experience I had with Japanese culture, how Japan that I knew in the 1980s and 90s had come about, because there was a very pronounced interest in Japan, and still is, in that period and the influences of that period as reflected in the works of artists. So, you know, your classic anime, for example, Akira, which was the big one when I was growing up, was that a sort of dystopian world of cyberpunk that was permanently, obsessively reflecting on the image of the bomb as some big white flash, and then the after effects, sort of mutagenic after effects in this post-apocalyptic punk world. So I was really interested in how that history kept on being repeated and reflected and reinterpreted, reimagined, and why.
Mm. Could you give us kind of a big picture overview of what the argument of your book is and the claim that you're making about this period in Japanese history?
Yeah, so the book's the product of all of that trajectory, I guess, in my life, through theater and academia, but also in Japan. So it's got quite a lot in it. It's quite dense. There's quite a lot of theory, but also history and politics. I was really interested to connect theatre with political context, a historical context, as well as theory. So it's not your run-of-the-mill sort of performance studies text that just might interpret the works of the artist within a frame of studying, say, performance or theatre. It's taking more of a wider lens, looking at history and politics as well, with the idea that, you know, I've always thought that theatre should and can engage in political and social ideas at a broader scale and shouldn't be, you know, permanently trying to fit within an entertainment model that, you know, has that prerogative of just keeping the audience captivated in a particular way without engagement in the bigger ideas, in the sort of transformative ideas. So that might be ambitious, but, you know, that's what I guess my studies have led me to as a conclusion about what theatre has always done as a social function. So in terms of this book, I look at the company I worked with, Gekidan Kaitaisha, trying to understand their work. They are a contemporary theatre company, I guess, that focuses mainly on the body and movement, and they call themselves a theatre company, which is kind of confusing for a Western theatre maker and audience, I guess, because theatre's always been understood as distinct from dance and performance because it has a script, has characters, you know, naturalism and realism, that kind of thing. But I guess they call themselves a theatre company because they also wanted to distinguish themselves from modern dance and postmodern dance, the dance tradition in that way. Nevertheless, they wanted to focus on the body. But they also derive their work, the key makers in the company, the main choreographer and the director, strongly influenced by the founder or co-founder of Ankoku Butō, or Butō as we know it today, Hijikata Tatsumi and Ono Kazuo. And Hino Hiroko, who's the main choreographer of Kaitaisha, she was she proudly names herself as Hijikata's last student before he died. So they had a very, you know, teacher and student in that tradition, have very close relations, and they maintain their relation to their student right until the end of their careers. So there's this kind of, I guess, artisanship where they hand down from teacher to student, from teacher to student, like that through the generations, knowing their legacy. I guess theatre makers do the same in the West as well. So they identified strongly with Butō. And so what I did in my analysis and research of Kaitaisha to understand their roots and their influences was to trace back to Butō and to Hijikata and Ono, and the ideas and the movement form and the practical concepts and form behind the work, tracing how those ideas were first originated with Butō, but then were translated and interpreted and changed in a different context in the 80s and 90s by Kaitaisha into the 2000s. So, yeah, I joined Kaitaisha in 2001 and worked with them for a number of years before then coming back to Australia.
So you talk about the form of Butō. I feel like for somebody with a maybe stereotyped image of what Japanese culture is like, we might think that Japanese culture is all about sort of very clean lines and this sort of minimalist aesthetic. But Butō is a very kind of unruly art form, right? It's a very like embodied and sometimes grotesque form of dance theater. Could you give our listeners a kind of brief description, kind of formally, what Butō is all about?
Yeah, sure. So Butō has gone through many generations. Now I think third generation, and many different styles and variations within that trajectory. And, you know, even within the Butō world, there's still debate about certain artists, whether they're doing Butō or not, what Butō actually is. There's no clear definition, and there's been a long-running debate in academic circles who have been interested in Butō about what Butō actually should be or is, or who said what and whose legacy which Butō dancer is performing within, that kind of thing. That said, the image of Butō, the mainstream general, well-known image that you're describing about clean lines and the kind of the white body, the white painted body, or the body in white rice flour, with very clean, minimal aesthetics, is probably derived from one strand of Butō, which would be your Sankaijuku, as probably the best known company that have traveled internationally, but also Daidakudakan, which is Maro Akaji's company that have also been engaged within the same generation for around 30 or 40 years. I mean, Butō dancers are incredibly fit, and so they managed to keep going forever. Butō dancers never die. Their rice flour just wears off or something like that. they're incredible as a discipline, that supposedly has no form. They seem to maintain their practice, and it sustains their lives. So Kazuo Ono, one of the founders, lived to over 100, and he was still dancing in his wheelchair. I remember one performance I saw where he came out for the encore, and people were throwing flowers, and he had so many flowers on him in his wheelchair that you couldn't see him, but all you could see was his hand still sort of dancing, moving as if he was throwing a ball up in the air. He had very big hands. He was known for his big hands, even though he performed the feminine. He was always performing in women's costumes, female costumes. So he was a bit of a legend. He lived longer than Hichikata, even though Hichikata was younger than him, about 20 years younger. And so the earlier form of Butō, beyond, earlier than the Daidakudakan and Sankaijuku, who were famous in the 1980s, from the 1980s on, was Ono and Hichikata and their first generation of students. And I was interested in understanding their work and their ideas, the sort of early form of Butō, if you like, the really rough form when it was still prototypical. In particular, Hichikata, but also Ono, even their makeup, their white body makeup, body mask, was much rougher, it was much thicker. So Hichikata was using this sort of plaster almost in the very early performances that would crumble off the bodies as they performed. When you do early plaster cast, it's that kind of rough, lumpy texture rather than the refined, kabuki or geisha kind of very faultless, perfect kind of mask that was used in that sort of refined aesthetic. This early Butō was much rougher, and it was in a rougher time too. It was emerging in 1960 or 1959 was the first official performance, although Hichikata and Ono were both doing performances before that with many artists around town. In Tokyo, that is. Both of them came from northern rural areas of Tohoku, which is in the northern region of Japan, of the main island. And they were responding to a time where Tokyo was still very polluted with the factories and the coal, which were using coal and spewing out coal dust into Tokyo, which was kind of covered with a film of grime during the period of recovery from the devastation of the war, where 65 major cities were bombed to roughly 80% of their existence at the end of the war. So you have a lot of rebuilding, recovery, but also rapid development. So the Kodo Seichoki, which is the rapid industrialization that happened in that 1950s, 60s period, meant that there was an incredible amount of congestion, pollution, building sites, when they're reconstructing the train system, for example, going on in major cities in Japan. Only in the 70s were those factories started to get moved out of the cities and into rural areas and then overseas. So, you know, the megalopolis that I saw in the 80s in Tokyo during the bubble when Japan was number one economy in the world was radically different from this 50s, 60s period, which I thus became fascinated by because I wanted to know a different Tokyo and where it had been built from, if that makes sense. And that would explain, sure. Also, that situation would explain why the aesthetic emerged. And so I was really interested in making that connection between that historical trajectory of those cities in Japan and also the movement form that came out of it. So I guess Hijikata in particular I focused on, and he was from a rural area, like I said, and he was one of the emigres to the cities of Japan in the 1950s looking for work, seasonal workers, you know, huge population of rural workers coming to cities in that period. And he expressed that aesthetic of the grimy worker, of the rural farmer, of the sort of marginal populations who were not of the cultured elite. And he was making an art form out of those characters, a kind of a marginal population of outcasts, if you like. And I guess I've always been attracted to outcast marginal culture. And so, yeah, that was really fascinating to me.
And then another theme that you explore in the book is the experience of occupation following the Japanese defeat in the Second World War. So could you talk a bit about how the experience of occupation by the American, state affected the development of Butoh?
Yeah, so in that period as well, you have this, like I was saying, this recovery period. Fukou is the word of Japanese recovery in the post-war. This was the famous kind of phoenix from the ashes, miraculous economic rise of Japan that has been ever since reiterated in Japanese history books, which was, I guess, a little bit of a myth-making exercise, which was because you have the Korean War, right, in 1950, and you have the Korean War being conducted on the US side or the UN side from Japan, from US bases in Japan, which had been established from 1945 with, you know, the first invasion of US troops after the, or just before the formal surrender of Japan, but after Japan's surrender on the 15th of August, they come in with over 400,000 troops and they set up US military bases and installations all over the country, all over the islands. In particular, they take Okinawa as U.S. territory, as a basically a garrison state, and they set up bases there, certainly, but also throughout Japan, on the main island, and surrounding Tokyo, actually. Five major bases, some of the largest in the world at that time, were built because Japan was such an important territory as part of U.S. geostrategic planning. To be able to, you know, project its power, forward projection is what they call it, into East Asia. So towards, you know, their target, which was to be able to contain the People's Republic of China, which wasn't the PRC yet, it was still in civil war, but anticipating that that would be necessary with, you know, the anticipated conflict with the Soviet Union, but also the socialist bloc. So Japan was central to the US geostrategic planning of the Cold War, which they already knew, the US planners already knew was going to take place during World War II. They were planning for the Cold War. Mm-hmm. It was a second stage of war, if you like, of US, you know, grand strategy. So the Cold War was already in formation during World War II, and Japan was central, a linchpin of an arc of bases or a crescent of bases that goes along the east coast of China and, you know, Far East and Russia, and right down to the Philippines, down to even as far around as Indonesia, I guess you could say, as an arc of bases that the US consolidated in their bilateral alliances with those countries as part of a security doctrine. And it was formally called the Truman Doctrine, but it's had many iterations since, and it's we're still living in that grand strategy now, in that sort of what's called the post-war international order. That grand strategy is part of that order. And US bases, I mean, now we have 800 plus around the world. So, you know, Japan is a crucial part of that. And the Japan-US alliance, as a result, has been really close, which has been also an economic alliance. So in this period, you know, there's a whole lot of farmers moving to the cities because there's no work in rural areas, including little Hijikata setting up his strange avant-garde dance form. And that, I argue, is a reflection of a condition in Japan that is essentially an occupied condition, by a foreign power that has over 400,000 troops, and that is reduced over the years down to about 45,000 now in Japan, but always a US presence in Japan that the Japanese people and Japanese government have had to negotiate. And what we see throughout this period during the Cold War in Japan is people, Japanese people, students, union members, laborers, workers, ordinary people, rising up in waves of protest against that occupation because they thought that at the end of the war they were going to finally have a democratic government that was going to represent the interests of the Japanese people as an autonomous entity. The people would have sovereignty. They would be able to vote for their parliamentary representatives who would represent their views in a contested, you know, adversarial space of parliament, and politics would run like that, and they would finally have their own say and be able to, you know, have their own will and bodies represented in politics. But it never really went that way, unfortunately. You know, you've got one political party who has been in power for over 70 years cumulatively. That's the LDP. So it's what's been called a one-and-a-half party system, where you've got one major party and then the rest of little parties that have had a look in and have had a little bit of a say but can't really determine the outcomes, political outcomes in that political space in Japan. And that has been aided very much and very closely by the US, by the ties, the alliance with the US. So those people who rose up in waves of protest against that occupation, against the military occupation, knew, recognized from at least 1950, if not before, that the US influence was very strong and was affecting Japanese autonomy, political autonomy and democratic process. And that was really evident because they saw a lot of the wartime officials, for example, leaders, return to government in the post-war, a phenomenon that wasn't just unique to Japan. It was also happening in West Germany, for example, where you have former Nazi officials returning to government. What is known as the rehabilitation process of former wartime officials to political positions. So they felt betrayed. Enormous betrayal. And I guess this sort of occupied condition is one where you don't feel that you have complete autonomy and independence, national independence. You can't determine your own country's directions and decisions and outcomes because you're permanently in relationship with another government, which is the US government. So I guess the Butoh form, to bring it back to theatre, is to say this fascinating form that focused mainly on the body and was quite silent, didn't use any text at all, was like a contorted, twisting, masked body that was covered in white plaster, lumpy plaster, that concealed an identity that had been suppressed in Japan, because that was antithetical to the direction that was being determined by two governments, the US and the Japanese government, with two heads of state, you know, the emperor and the prime minister in Japan, but also the US president, during the military occupation, the formal military occupation under the supreme command of allied powers under General Douglas MacArthur, by, you know, the US leader in Japan until 1952. So you've got this weird, what I call a bicephalous state, dual-headed, that the Japanese people had to follow and had to take orders from, because, you know, military occupation is basically martial law. But even after 1952, I argue this, that Japan is still occupied because it still has a very prominent foreign presence, foreign military presence, that is distorting and contorting the national politics and the democratic process, and has for a long time. This is not unique, of course, to Japan. Many other countries have this sense of lack of independence or real democracy since the 1945 period because of these larger geostrategic and geopolitical concerns.
So in terms of the kind of aesthetics of Buto, could you give us a sense of, you know, if we were to go back in time to the 1950s and see our production that Hijikata Tatsumi put on, you know, what would we see on this stage, and kind of what would be, you know, what are the aesthetic characteristics of this performance? You mentioned the kind of you know, the lumpy makeup and the white and the very minimalist kind of stage setup, but what happens over the course of the event?
Yeah, so
obviously it would depend on the production, but can you give us a kind of general sense of what the aesthetic and formal characteristics of the form would be?
Yeah, so I think it's really idiosyncratic. I mean, if a little bit not shambolic, but not your typical kind of well-made theater or dance piece that you would see with high production values that you'd see today. This is also partially why I was attracted to this early form of Ankoku Budo. It was much more raw, and the ideas and the form and the choreography and the scenes were not fitting into what you might call formal dance or theatre or performance that as we know it today. You know, it was a kind of hodgepodge of a whole lot of ideas and images and movements and costume and scenography to reflect very particular conditions of the time, right, that I was just outlining before. Now, Hijikata was known for several famous landmark performances as Ankoku Buto. He was also a performer, so he performed in many other shows as well. But the major ones that we know from the historiography are Kinjiki, or Forbidden Colors, which is named after Mishima's famous novel that was performed in 1959. And then you have another one called Anma, which means blind masseurs, and that was 1963, rosy-coloured dance in 1965. And then his kind of piece de resistance, which is the Hijikata Tatsumi and Japanese People, the Revolt of the Body, or Nikutai no Handan in 1968. This is a time of tension and conflict in Tokyo where all these protests are going on, led by students and union members, against the renewal of the Mutual Security Treaty with the United States. So there's a very energetic environment in which Hijikata is putting on these shows. But Kinjiki, for example, was performed as part of the formal Japanese Dance Association, which was probably used to doing chamber pieces to European composers. So, you know, Chopin or Liszt or something like that. And Hijikata puts on this show called Forbidden Colors after a book by Mishima that is about a homoerotic relationship between a Japanese boy and a US GI who's, well, at least this is part of it. This is part of the story, but this is the main characters that are represented in the show. And Ono Yoshito, who's the son of Ono Kazuo, he performs the young girl or boy. It's an effeminate character with a lemon yellow scarf and very pale skin, and has a sort of a gentle, soft, fluid movement. And Hijikata has painted himself black with olive oil and grease paint, and he's sort of the masculine figure. Although it's never stated that these are the characters that they're specifically representing, and the implication is pretty much clear. And the music is a kind of popular genre using blues harp and a kind of downbeat street music that is popular. So not classical, not European, popular street culture, and referring to some sort of relationship between a black GI and a Japanese person that is sexual. So they get kind of pushed out of the Japanese Dance Association almost immediately, and thus, you know, Uncle Kabuto is born. But so it's a scandal, essentially, of what you're crossing a threshold by transgression and talking about a taboo. There were many in Japan during this period, and that taboo was some sort of idea of black Japanese sexual relationship or Afro-American Japanese sexual relationship, let alone homoerotic, let alone with a foreign occupier who you're not supposed to fraternize with. Of course, there was heaps of fraternization in the Japanese clubs around US bases all the time. So this was a real shock to what was considered acceptable in social mores of the time, and what was considered culture or dance or refined aesthetics to be appreciated by a rarefied Japanese audience. So that was his launch, and it was really successful. And from there, he built on the form. And so Anma, again, was a different aesthetic, which had old women from, well, they were probably in Tokyo, but they were wearing clothes that indicated that they came from a rural area, playing shamisen. Anma means blind masseur, which is a tradition in Japan of blind people becoming masseurs, women in particular, and they would be almost shamanic in their healing skills through touch. So this was referring to a kind of culture that was being rapidly erased in the rapid modernization of Japan. Not that Japan wasn't already modernized, but its industrialization was expanding in this 1950s period. And that culture was considered shameful or backward or primitive or kind of somehow indigenous and to be embarrassed by, because Japan was on the move. It was becoming this techno-scientific, hyper-industrialist, capitalist power, right, returning to the world stage after having been defeated. It was already that, but it was doing it even more in this period. And Hijikata was saying, no, we still have this culture, this rich tradition, this legacy that we should not forget. And so he had young men in this thick white plaster throwing baseballs at each other, he rode in on a, I think it was him. He rode in on a bicycle halfway through the performance. They had a massive map of a human body with the points, with the Chinese medicine points on it. They had someone swinging in the swing on the stage. People called out from the audience when they saw something they liked or recognized or identified with. You know, this kind of atmosphere was generated almost like a street festival performance, you know, where people mm-hmm. felt free to engage vocally while the performance was ongoing, rather than that sort of still silenced form of reception as if you're listening to a classical orchestra or something like that. So, yeah, that was Anma. And then with the later work, say, Hijikata, The Revolt of the Body, that was a solo. That was Hijikata's solo performance, landmark solo performance, 1968, 100 years since the modernization of Japan under Meiji, the restoration of the emperor. And he gives this kind of costume performance where he changes many times into different costumes. One of the famous ones is he's wearing a gold prosthetic phallus strap-on with wild black hair, and he's smashing into hanging brass plates that make a sort of like a massive cymbal. So, you know, he's making these crashing sounds. And then he gets in a ball gown with black gloves on. Then he's doing a kind of like an Argentinian tango with castanets. He's a schoolgirl skipping with a skipping rope with his hair in pigtails, and then finally he ties himself up in a loincloth and pulls himself from the stage by ropes as if a sort of a sacrificial gift, I guess, to the audience. And he takes the applaud, the curtain call with a fish in his mouth. So this is a famous performance. I'm not doing it justice, obviously, and it's been forensically dissected by many scholars, including Bruce Baird, who's a wonderful Butoh scholar, but many, many others. Inada Naomi, Mikami Kayo, Kuniyoshi Kazuko, all of these scholars have engaged with this work, Ishii Tatsuro, because it's so evocative, and because I guess it was like maybe ahead of its time in terms of a performance, live performance quality, you know, performance art mixed with theatre, live art kind of approach. If you want to see it like that, you could also see it as continuing in the Dada tradition of performance, you know, in the avant-garde theatre tradition from Alfred Jarry, you know, the Ubu Roy, or that kind of legacy, which I point out at those connections in the book. So, yeah, that's your kind of world that Butoh was engaged in at that time.
So it's very clear from your descriptions that engagement with history, engagement with tradition is a big part of Hijikata's work. In the political context of the time, would that work have been understood as, I don't know, broadly conservative or broadly left-wing, or is that a frame that's not useful in analyzing the political implications of this work?
No, it's incredibly useful. I mean, I think that, you know, theatre is inextricable from historical conditions and political conditions and social conditions. You can't separate them. You have to understand what was going on at the time, but what has preceded it, in order to understand how that work is manifesting what has gone on. The fact that they're working from the body itself, for me, says that they're engaging with history, because the body is the sum of everything that has taken place beforehand. You could go back right until the beginning of time, but not just scientifically. The body is the sum of the gestures and the movements and the relationships and the historical conditions that body and its descent, its forebears have lived through. So, you know, if you've got a if you've got a bad toe but that you've inherited from your parents and their parents, that's likely because of some kind of labor or conditions that those forebears engaged with, right? So, it's a permanent engagement with history, and I'd say that I read Hijikata's works as mini ethnographies of people's lives and life worlds that come out. If you look closely enough, you can see, you can delve into those works, and you can find those people and the way that they lived in those times, who have often been forgotten. And this is the argument that I make in the book. I say that, you know, these life worlds and life ways have been erased by the dominant trajectory of historical progress, if you could call it that, or, you know, modernization or capitalist development in Japan that was rapid, rapacious, so forceful in the way that it erased history, not just because there was so much destruction to be cleared away, but also because that historical memory of that destruction was also at the same time being erased. So you've got this history problem being born at this time in Japan that has vexed Japanese society ever since, of how to deal with what happened during the war, why it happened, who did what, who was responsible. And, you know, in order to take responsibility properly so as to prevent it from happening again. I mean, this is your classic reason for studying history in the first place. But what I'm saying is that through theatre, we can also understand these histories, people's histories, that often get ignored because of the dominant focus in historiography on state politics and, you know, high officials and leaders and diplomats and this kind of history with a big H. No, I think theatre is a wonderful way to try to understand human evolution and through the body in particular. So, yeah, the study of Buto is the study of the history of the body. It's the study of forgotten people's histories, microhistories, anthropology, that kind of engagement with traditions and cultures. And what you find in Japanese history is this not a monolithic kind of homogenous national history which talks about the formation of the Japanese nation state from Meiji to the present, you know, with the restoration of the emperor and the kind of consolidation of the Japanese people as one nation and one people and one race. No, what you find is that Japan has a multiplicity, or a polyphony is what I call it, of ethnicities, of languages, of peoples who have moved in and out of those islands over a long period of time. But they've just been written out. So you've got the Ainu in the north, you've got the Ryukyu in the south, you've got any number of migrants who've gone through those islands from Korea, from China, from the Philippines, from the South Pacific, from even as far as South America as traders, and you've got the Western influence, of course, moving throughout Japan all the time. And you've got those histories that can be understood, and therefore you change your understanding of what Japanese identity actually is. So I think, yeah, Buto also offers that opportunity to learn.
Great. I think this is a good opportunity to transition into talking about Theater of Deconstruction, which you mentioned a bit earlier. Could you talk about what the kind of political and aesthetic aims of Theater of Deconstruction were, how they perhaps differed from what Hijikata was up to in earlier decades?
Yeah, so Hijikata was very much, like I said, he was traveling back to his roots and looking at the, you know, where his family had come from and what they'd experienced. I also forgot to mention that Hijikata famously talked about how people from the north, from Tohoku, from the rural areas up there, were an internal colony, which meant that, you know, in the formation of Japan as a nation state, you had these areas that were gradually colonized by Kyoto and then Edo, the capital, as part of a homogenous nation. But they didn't feel like they were necessarily Japanese in the modern sense. They were people from Tohoku. and they were farmers and they were rural villagers. And they felt, as a result, they resisted actually the restoration of the emperor in war militarily. They conducted military conflict to try to protect their territory from being assimilated. And so forever since, people in Tohoku have had a slightly different view of the capital because they've always, what Hijikata said was that they've always provided geisha, soldiers, horses, and rice. So they were your classic kind of internal colony that supplied the raw materials to boost the primitive accumulation process of the capital. And in that period of the empire that was expanding into East Asia. So that said, that's a very important point because it's looking at the capital from the periphery rather than the other way around. And Butoh comes from that, if you like, and Hijikata was always trying to move back to that area, even though he was in Tokyo in that time. And he goes through different stages, and towards the end of his life, he tries to go back to his childhood and back to that understanding of looking at Japan from that perspective. So what Kaitaisha did, Shimizu Shinjin, who's the director, and Hino Hiruko, who's the main choreographer, was that they reinterpreted Hijikata's work to repoliticize it, to bring back the politics that Hijikata was trying to convey that got written out during the 80s, which is a particularly apolitical time in Japan, in popular culture and consciousness, at least, and to upgrade the images, I guess, that were being put on stage. So taking the fundamental movement principles that were used in Hijikata's day, but to put it more in a transnational or an international context. So Shimizu is an autodidact. He's a, you know, reader of theory and history, as well as being a theatre director. And he has a much more global perspective. So Japan, by this point, has recovered well and truly, and is on the international, in the international arena, and has a much more, once again, international perspective. So Hijikata never travelled overseas during his lifetime, and it was very much about an internal process about Japanese identity, but. Shimizu is with Kaitaisha traveling all the time, and while I was working with them, we traveled to many different places, great festivals, engaged with lots of different artists in sort of multicultural, international collaborations. So much more globalized perspective, if you like, and Shimizu theorizes that as part of not from, you know, nation to the world, but as a global system within a global distribution system. And he theorizes the human body still, you know, very much through the lens of the body within this global globalized system of, or global system of capitalism. And he tries to understand in particular the human body in relation to the media, because he associates globalization with an ever intensifying mediation, a media system. So his work and his scenography is placing those human bodies within that, those structures of power. He's very much concerned with how structures of power work, but also how they inform how we see our bodies and how we work with our bodies, how we can work with our bodies in an embodied medium like live performance within this, what he calls a virtual system, which is, you know, very 1990s kind of postmodern theory, but it's pretty relevant. Still, I mean, these things haven't gone away, and they never go away. I mean, you know, to your question about the left, for example, and whether it's useful anymore to look at the world through those lenses, I don't think if you start to embrace a historical worldview, you know, we're still dealing with 75 years since the end of World War II. That's like a tiny little blip in terms of not only human evolution, but planetary evolution. So it's not surprising that these themes continue to return. We're still living, unfortunately, in a period of empire. I don't think empire has really gone away either. It's just mm-hmm. taken a different form and a particularly powerful form that is globalized, well and truly globalized. So while Kaitaisha are making work, you know, you've got the emergence of the new sat wars, the satellite wars of, you know, say the Persian Gulf War, and then you've got war in Yugoslavia, and then you've got the Iraq War and Libya and Syria, etc. And these wars are all being communicated through satellite, so operated through remotely or virtually, as Shimizu would say. So you've got this massive apparatus that is global, using weapons in space or telecommand in space, as Paul Virilio would call it, to control these massive operations, military operations, with the individual body exposed to this power. What does that do to us? You know, how do we reflect? How do we communicate and express ourselves and understand our conditions within this environment? I think that's where Kaitaisha really went with it, and it was really exciting to experience that when I was working with them.
And how does that emphasis on kind of media saturation, you know, I think of maybe Guy Debord as a kind of, you know, society of the spectacle, that kind of an idea of, you know, everything being through this screen of mediation. How does that show up in the work of theater of deconstruction in kind of how they perform?
Yeah.
I mean, are they performing next to, you know, video screens a la the Wooster Group, or is it, how do they deal with those kind of technological themes?
Yeah. So when I joined in 2001, we did a couple of workshops, and then we went on a tour, and the tour was doing a production called Bye Bye, The New Primitive. Bye Bye meaning goodbye, but also, or sayonara in Japanese, but also having a double meaning, which is bye bye, which is to sell, to consume and to sell. And so we go on this tour and we're performing in Europe, in Frankfurt, Dusseldorf, Hamburg, and then the September 11 attacks happen. And we're scheduled to perform at the New York Japan Society 10 days after. So we fly into New York and, you know, people are still kind of in lockdown, not coming out of their houses, and you can still smell the concrete dust from, you know, way up in the mid-50s from the explosions or from the collapse of the buildings. And for many in the audience who come to see the show, it's the first time they've come out of their houses, really. And the show is about Japanese history, so it's, you know, it's using words like Meiji Taisho Showa, which are the names of the pre-war and wartime emperors. And, you know, there's a quote from Article 9, which is in the Japanese Constitution, which is written in 1947 primarily by the US occupiers, which is saying the Japanese will forego the use of military force in settling international disputes. So it's basically the peace clause, which has restrained Japan from, not from rearming, but from engaging in international conflict to settle disputes forever and a day, right? And that constitution has been under constant contestation in Japan, particularly by conservative forces, to become, you know, to get rid of it, to revise it, to become a normal nation, and to be able to engage in war overseas. which Japan then actually does in the Iraq War in 2003, 2 years later. And it also shows, well, me being the only white performer at that time in the company in the show, it shows me slapping the back of a smallish woman performer who's painted grey with a mouse tail and a Roman centurion's helmet. And when I slap her, she spits blood and she says the names of the emperors. So that kind of evocative historical political imagery, let alone, you know, the shock of me slapping a woman repetitively on the back so that you can hear the slaps, right, is confronting to the people in the audience. And a lot of them stay back for the after talk and they ask Shimizu, look, you know, we know, and also I forget to mention, there's an image that is, there are images of basically of aerial bombing and the sounds of helicopters and gunfire and explosions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in certain parts of the show and scenography that is to suggest a battlefield, a modern battlefield. You know, you get images, you think of Vietnam or you think of the Gulf War, or Persian Gulf War or something like that. And they say, look, we know this show is about us, but we're good people. Why has this happened to us? Referring to September 11. And that was the time when, wow, I decided to go back to academia.
Some talk
back. That's when I thought, okay, there's a master's.
Yeah, wow.
So I wanted to understand, not only, I mean, there was a really leading question because it was like, well, what news are you reading? What have you been reading? Right. You know, what story have, right, you been told? What is history doing? How is history formed? How is this narrative shaped? What have you been, you know, have you been living under a rock? Why don't you understand this? And I thought that was a really good point to start.
Even that anecdote of the clause in the Constitution forbidding Japan from engaging in military aggression, it's like just an extraordinary example of kind of the arrogance of American imperialism in that, you know, you bomb a country with two atomic bombs and with countless firebombs, and then you make them sign a pledge to be peaceful and diplomatic. I mean, that's just perfect, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like tying someone's hands behind their back and then tickling them and telling them not to laugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, to make a massive understatement. But, yes, that's right. And the atomic bombs have always been used as, well, at first were used as a kind of blackmail, as a form of terror, which is to say, look, if you don't comply, we're going to do it again, or we're going to threaten you with this massive force until you comply. But what gets missed in that narrative is also, of course, the erasure of the war of aggression that the Japanese Empire conducted, right? So the expansion, mm-hmm, first, you know, since Meiji, since 1868, the Japanese were all expanding. You know, they colonized first Hokkaido and Okinawa from the indigenous there, the Kuriles, the Sakhalin. They expanded into Taiwan, into Korea, through war, of course. This is how it was done, or is done. You contest to show who's got the most amount of power, and then you claim their territories like trophies. And, you know, it doesn't matter what the locals think. You then govern or rule or use those territories for your own empire's strengthening to continue to expand. And this is precisely what the United States has done since, well, you know, we could say since the beginning, since
1775 or 6.
Yeah, or
perhaps
maybe the genocide of, yeah, the Native American Indian people.
Yeah, even before that, yeah.
Before that in the 17th century. With the Puritans, but and interestingly enough, I mean, Hijikata has a great performance called Smallpox, which Hosotan, which was a beautiful performance because he was playing an old woman or dancing an old woman, and he sort of moved really stiffly like he'd been working in a rice paddy for 50 years. And he performed on really high geta, which are those wooden sandals, you know, with the blocks underneath. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he tilted them forward and did that sort of hunched over posture. And there was a sound of a crow in the background, and he was wearing a shabby old kimono and from a rural area. And it was very, the sound of wind, that's right, very harsh, cold rural area wind. That figure is the agrarian figure that has been exposed to the violence of this expansive power and force that we're talking about. Whether it was under Japanese empire or American empire is no difference. Mm. Those figures are the people who have been had their hands tied behind their backs and not us, and asked not to protest or to fight. I'm not talking about the state, you know, the Japanese state as having a claim. I'm talking about the people who have been exposed to the dual-headed or multi-headed force and power and abuse and domination of those empires. Those are the people that haven't spoken and we haven't heard. And it's continued.
And those are the people.
Yeah.
Sorry, those are the people that Hijikata and others in the Butoh tradition are in some ways trying to give, maybe not voice to, because it's not a vocal, not a particularly vocal art form, but trying to give representation to in some way, the people who've been kind of forgotten and left out of the historical narrative.
Yeah, those are the people I'm saying that Hijikata was giving voice to, and Ono to some extent was giving voice to. But, you know, people in the Butoh tradition have different perspectives on this, just as they have different perspectives and politics on Japan and on Japan's Japanese Empire and on the US. So, mm-hmm. you know, you'll find a lot of maybe implicit, maybe not direct, but you'll find tacit debate and disagreement within Butoh circles about this because, you know, Japan goes through a very nationalist phase in the 1980s. It is still, but you find also that some of the Butoh dancers were quite nationalist in the sense that they were claiming victimhood from the atomic bombs and that they were dancing somehow the victims of those bombings and the aerial bombings, which, you know, were indiscriminate, disproportionate. We should never forget that. But they're also not recognizing any responsibility for the aggression of the Japanese Empire, which actually led to, you know, that we don't even know the numbers of how many people died and were maimed during that period of imperial expansion and aggression. So even though we have pretty accurate numbers of what happened in Europe. So, you know, it ranges from between conservatively from about 10 million to about 22 million. But actually it could go anything up to about 36 or 38 million. But we don't talk about those people because those people's histories, precisely the ones I'm talking about, particularly in East Asia, in Vietnam, in China, in the Philippines, in Indonesia, are not included in historical texts. Mm-hmm. So they don't get remembered, even though they've got lives and experiences and histories and families and, you know, ancestors, etc., and knowledge and religions, all that stuff. They just don't get included because of this dispensation that we've been living under since then.
I spent a semester studying at Shanghai Theatre Academy.
Oh, wow.
And we saw a performance that, you know, the war against the Japanese is a very popular topic for film and television and theater.
Yeah, I bet.
In China. Yeah. And we saw a play that was depicting the Japanese as these sort of like mustache twirling villains, you know. And I was talking to a Chinese friend of mine on the way out of the performance, and I have said, you know, I was kind of shocked to see the Japanese portrayed like basically these Nazis.
Yeah.
And this friend of mine just very straight faced said to me, the Japanese were Nazis.
Right. So.
So yeah, I mean, we don't think about the ways that you know, certainly the Chinese and many other populations in East Asia were kind of victimized by the Japanese before, you know, before we started kind of imposing similar forms of cultural occupation on them.
Yeah, well, you know, as a historian of Asia, I try to do this all the time, which is to try to encourage my students to think about it from all perspectives. So on the one hand, yes, from the Chinese perspective, the Japanese Empire were, they name it, you know, anti-Japan war of resistance or something like this.
Right. They don't call it the Second World War. They call it the anti-Japanese war.
And, you know, the Chinese also say, well, which war are you talking about? Because, you know, during the Qing Dynasty, you've got an uprising, you know, that left 20 million dead. So, you know, they've really been through the ringer for 400 or 500 years at least, let alone fighting the Mongols. But you've also got to remember that, yes, so the Chinese have this perspective of suffering the brunt of the Japanese imperial war machine, just like the Soviet Union has the perspective of suffering the brunt of the Nazi war machine. It wasn't the West Anglo-American allies who won the war, it was the Soviet Union, because they suffered so much of that war, losing 27 million people. We have to remember that too. But we don't hear that, right? We only see wars, films like General Patton or this kind of stuff. But also you've got to remember that, you know, slavery, for example, existed in Imperial China, just as it existed in, say, you know, in the Aztecs or in the Mayans or in these pre-modern, pre-nation empires, similar formations and phenomena and dynamics manifested. So at the same time as criticizing the dominant Western narrative, which is what many Japanese like to criticize, we also have to remember that this is not one civilization that is wholly responsible for this dynamic in human history. So a much more nuanced view would be to recognize, yes, Japanese war of aggression, but Chinese imperialism too, in the pre-modern formation, was extremely oppressive. And it had tribute states, and it had, you know, slavery, and it had torture, and it killed many people during the building of the Chinese Great Wall of China, workers who were disposable, etc. Under empire. So what is it really that's driving this human capacity for violence, for extreme large scale violence, is one of the themes, I guess, that Kaitaisha are looking at. They don't go that far, but they're looking at it at the site of the body. So they're trying to look for primal causes of violence and power and force, trying not to erase that is one of their objectives, I think.
Well, Adam Bronowski, I've taken so much of your time, and thank you so much for this fascinating conversation. I really feel like that idea of trying to see all sides of these very complicated questions is something you model really beautifully in your book. So thanks so much for taking the time to talk about it on New Books in Performing Arts.
Oh, I was really glad for the opportunity. Thanks for listening and finding it interesting. I'm glad that there are people out there who do. And yeah, if you're interested, read the book.
Yes, certainly.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, talk to you soon.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.